Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on our website, 989fm.com.au, or on the podcast a little bit later, welcome to you as well. It's really good to have your company. Now, I think it was last week, a really troubling story broke up in the Northern Territory, and it concerned one of our most loved Aboriginal singers. And he's not just known in Aboriginal Australia, he's an international sensation. He's a national treasure. I'm talking about Geoffrey Gurrumul Yunupingu. Now, he was actually left in the emergency department for 8 hours with internal bleeding. I mean, he could have died. You know, this could have been a really tragic story we're talking about right now. Because he was misdiagnosed, I guess, as being an alcohol abuser when really it was a condition that he'd had in childhood, hepatitis B, that he'd contracted when he was a kid. So that broke. And earlier this week, there was really horrendous comments from the NT Attorney General up there, John Elferink. And I'm not actually surprised Mr. Elferink made these comments because they're well within his character. But he basically accused Gurrumul and his managers of sort of drumming up a publicity stunt for his new album, which I found just absolutely atrocious. And I think most Australians would find that atrocious. And then the other day I was reading in The Guardian a piece from a doctor or a health professional actually questioning whether this was a case of rushed medicine or racial profiling. Now, we don't have this, we don't talk about these things when it's a white singer, because often, obviously, it would never happen, would it? Now, I was very privileged. This thing with Gurrumul, this horrendous tragedy with Gurrumul, actually coincided with the visit of a very esteemed scholar from America, an African-American man, David Williams, who's a professor at the Harvard University, a sociologist, and one of the leading authorities in the field of racism and health, linking racism to health determinants. And I spoke to him earlier today, earlier this week, because he was in town for a short visit, only 2 days actually, for the Indigenous Cancer Conference here in Brisbane. So we came into the studio and we had a really fascinating chat about the evidence around the linkage between racism and health. And there's a lot of evidence. And I kept thinking of the case of Miss Dewey as well, as how her pain was totally misinterpreted. And we talked about this thing called unconscious bias, which there's a lot of evidence of as well. But that's enough from me. I'll hand over to the interview with David Williams. David Williams in the studio too. Could you tell us a bit about your background and your position over at Harvard University?
Okay. It's really good to be here with you. I am a professor of public health, sociology, and African and African-American studies at Harvard University. I've been a faculty member. This would be 30 years, actually. I started out at Yale University, an elite private university in the United States. I was there for 6 years until I got promoted to associate professor. And then I went to the University of Michigan as a faculty member. I had been trained. I did my doctorate at the University of Michigan, so went back to University of Michigan and was a faculty member there for 14 years. So I've now been at Harvard for 10 years.
And you specifically researched the issue of racism and the links between public health. When did you start to think of that as an issue?
I have been interested in health. And I've been interested in social factors that affect health. And racism isn't the only social factor I study. So I do work, I've done work on social relationships and the ways in which social relationships affect health. I began doing work on socioeconomic status, how health varies by income, education, occupational status. I've done work more generally on stress and the ways in which stress affects health and health behaviors have an impact on health. And I've done work on religious involvement and how religious involvement and spirituality affects health. So I've been interested in factors outside of the traditional biomedical model that have consequences for health. And my work on racism grew out of my larger interest in understanding social inequality and its effects on health, and understanding race as one dimension of social inequality. One thing I would say is that when I started my career, most researchers knew that there were large racial differences in health in the United States. The general assumption was that most of the racial gap was due to differences between the races in income and education and wealth. And the belief was that if we compared people of different racial groups at the same level of income or education, there would be no effect of race.
So take racism out of it, make it a class issue, was what people sort of believed.
People thought
in.
That class was a driver. It wasn't even take racism out of it. No one was thinking about racism.
They were
just thinking of their large differences between the races in income and education, and that is responsible for why. And I think some of that was very progressive. And I say that was very progressive in the sense that for more than 150 years, medical research in the United States had been documenting racial differences in health.
Yep.
And the knee-jerk explanation for any racial difference observed was biology.
It was
due to the genetic differences between racial groups. And
which
so,
obviously isn't a factor, really.
Which is not a factor, but so that I think the progressive social scientists who were rejecting that view of biological determinism was saying, yes, it's just about the differences in social inequality between the groups. And if we looked at people at the same levels of income and education, there would be no racial effect left. And then, in fact, when we started to do that, we found that, yes, at every level of income and education, there still is a racial gap.
Right.
There still is a racial difference. And so the question becomes, what else is there that is driving it? What else is it about race that matters for health? And how do we, I've been a researcher, a research scientist, I've published almost 400 scientific papers over my career. So the question is, how can we begin to identify and unpack what it is about race that matters?
And I guess it's such a complex issue, but I guess what are the broad parameters of that? What are the broad issues that play into it?
Well, I mean, at one level, it is complex. At another level, it is not more complex than other scientific challenges that we try to understand. So I think for me, it was, well, let's put our minds to it. I was telling you earlier of a story that I distinctly remember being at a conference in the early 1990s and talking about the need to better understand the contribution of racism to health. And a well-intentioned white researcher sitting in the audience afterwards said, well, I think Dr. Williams is right that racism is a factor, but we will never be able to do what he wants us to do because we can never develop measures of racism. So it's impossible to do. And I said to him, if you said to me today, do we have valid, reliable measures of racism that we can use in our studies, I would say no. But there is no reason why we couldn't develop measures of racism. We just need to put our minds to it. And I said, we have measures of self-esteem.
Yeah.
If we could develop measures of self-esteem, why can't we develop measures of racism? And for me, that was an impetus, not the only reason, but one additional reason to say, this is unacceptable. We need to do better. We need to develop measures.
Why do you think there was that reluctance to even consider that or not even broach it?
It was so controversial. I am not going to call the name, but there's a senior researcher in my field who happens to be black. And he was well respected in the field of public health. And he said to me once, maybe about 15 years ago, you know, thanking me for my work, looking at racism and saying to me that he, early in his career, where there were even fewer blacks at his time, he's retired now, there were even fewer blacks in his day than in my day. And he felt that racism was something that should be studied, that he wanted to study, but he knew that he couldn't do it.
Because of the backlash.
There would be backlash. There would be no support. It'd be a problem. I can also remember, this is about the mid-1990s. I am writing my first research grant in the United States, a major source of researchers for research funding for researchers who study health is called the National Institutes of Health. It's the federal government has a research institute that provides money, and there's a process by which you write a grant and submit it, and it's reviewed. And I remember this is the first time I'm writing a grant now to study the effects of racism and health. And I had racism in the title, and I had racism throughout the grant. And wisely, I sent it to a colleague of mine to review and give me feedback. It's a good strategy always to get feedback before you submit. And he called me up and said, David, take the racism out. Do you want to get funded or not?
Well.
And I did what he said. So instead of, the grant was about racism and health, a study of determinants. I rewrote the grant instead of racism and health. I called it race-related stress and health. And I would say, this is not a precise count, but I would say maybe in the first version, it's a 20-page single-spaced application. In the first version, the term racism might have been in the grant 120 times. In my revised version, it was there 3 or 4 times.
You totally had to whitewash it.
Exactly. But I called it race-related stress. It was now about race-related stressors and their effects on health. It's the same thing. I did not change one thing about what I was doing.
Yeah.
I just didn't use the word racism because people were saying to me, this is going to be a problem. Reviewers are not going to like it. You're not going to get funded. And I think sometimes, you know, you've been as wise as serpents and harmless as doves is politically necessary sometimes. I have colleagues who wouldn't do that. I had a conversation with one colleague about this, and she feels that naming it is so important. And I said, well, you need to think of strategically, what is your goal? And what do you want to accomplish? And for me, my goal was to get the funding, to do the work, to put racism on the agenda.
And obviously it's happened. So
exactly. And so that's the big goal. So you don't lose sight of what you're trying to accomplish. And so for me, that was not the moment of truth where I was trying to educate the reviewer of my grant. I was just trying to get the reviewer of my grant to give me money to do the work I wanted to do. And I didn't compromise what I was going to do. I just packaged it in a way that was palatable to the reviewer.
Now, as an Aboriginal person, I guess, and probably the same with you, you sort of see racism in play in every day, I guess, in whatever you do. It's at the forefront of your mind. So I think it seems almost logical that we would link racism to health. But you talk about the need for empirical evidence and to go behind that and unpack that. How do we even begin to start, or how did you begin to start unpacking that?
Well, I mean, I think to develop empirical evidence, you have to develop measures. You can't study something empirically if you don't have measures of the phenomenon. And so if you have measures of the phenomenon, you can measure it, then you can now assess its relationship between measures of discrimination and measures of health. I should back up and say something that I think is so important. I've developed measures that capture, I would say, interpersonal aspects of discrimination. And I see discrimination as one piece of racism. I do see racism as much more profound and much more systemic and much more institutionally driven than is discrimination. And I say that this is not where you were coming from, but I think it's important for the audience to understand that I run into a lot of people who say, oh, David has developed a scale that measures racism. And I usually tell them, no, I have not.
Yeah.
Because racism, yes, and we can talk about the everyday discrimination scale that I've developed. It's a 9-item scale. It measures one small aspect of the phenomenon of interpersonal discrimination.
But I think that's important because people get hung up on the everyday racism when really the big game is that institutionalized racism that leads to these public health outcomes.
You are exactly right. I believe that the most profound and pervasive ways in which racism affects health is through processes of institutional racism, where there are policies and procedures that have built into into social institutions, into public policy, into law that shapes outcomes in most profound ways.
Yeah.
In the context of the U.S., I point to residential segregation by race as the, I wrote a paper in 2001 that it's a fundamental cause of racial inequalities in
health. And can we explain to our listeners what residential segregation actually was?
Okay, sure. So the history of the United States is that as the U.S. was a British colony after supposedly Columbus discovered it.
like Captain Cook discovered Australia. No,
exactly. So a very, very similar scenario is the official story. The indigenous populations in the Americas in general were wiped out to a large degree, many by diseases that the Europeans had brought. And there was a need in these developing colonies to have a large, stable workforce. And so they went to Africa and imported slaves to Africa. In the United States, the slaves were freed in 1865. There was enormous concern. I mean, here are people who had been property and had now been freed. There was enormous concern about how were we going to handle this problem, because the widespread view of even people who fought for freedom for the slaves and the end of the slave trade, they nonetheless believed that blacks were biologically inferior, and they were biologically a different species.
So we had to keep them away. We could give them their freedom.
You had to protect yourself. So the question was, how would you protect yourself? And so in the 1880s, 1890s, we call them Jim Crow laws were developed that required separate accommodations, that required separate cars on the train. Blacks and whites couldn't sit in the same section of the train, that required on buses blacks to sit in the back, that required separate accommodations in hotels, that even required separate toilet facilities, that required separate restaurants.
So African Americans and white people were segregated even the way they lived, obviously.
They were and then it also required, it went to housing, and then it required that you had separate areas of a city where blacks, there were areas where blacks could live and there were areas where whites would live. And part of it was to preserve the purity of the white race and to prevent contact between blacks and whites, especially any kind of romantic or sexual contact.
Yeah, right.
There was enormous concern of what the negative effects that kind of mixing would have had. There was, in fact, a very famous scientific study in the early 1840s that documented that any kind of interracial marriage led to insanity. And that freedom also led to insanity. The researcher claimed that the further north in the United States, basically the U.S., northern states did not have official slavery, although there were cases of a family might have had slaves, whereas in the south there were slaves. And this researcher claimed that the further north blacks lived, the higher were their rates of insanity.
Yeah.
Evidence, he declared, that slavery, that slavery was what blacks were naturally made for, and that freedom was so inconsistent with the nature of what blacks needed that freedom drove blacks mad. It made them crazy because it was so inconsistent with their nature. So basically, the key point is there was a structure put in place that required blacks and whites to live in separate areas. They could not live in the same neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And the notion was the neighborhoods would be separate but equal. But in fact, they were not.
That's not what happened.
That's yep. a joke. They were not. And importantly, the laws that required and policies that required residents in separate neighborhoods were all struck down in the 1960s. So it's no longer the law of the land.
But it's
so
still unofficially, I guess, the law.
It is still the practice. Yeah. And it, for a number of reasons, there are still subtle ways in which the status quo is maintained. But there's a second and more profound way, and I see the same thing in South Africa. South Africa had the same system. There were black areas and white areas. And
well, apartheid was based on Queensland, where we are right now.
Yes.
The Protection Acts that control the lives of our mob over here. So.
Yes. So that the fact that you have ended the laws in the areas where whites lived, property values are higher, homes are more expensive.
Mm.
And for black people who are making a fraction of the income that whites live, the fact that you've now made it legal that black people can now buy a home in this white neighborhood, they can't possibly afford a home in the white neighborhood.
Yeah, so they're still happen. Out of there anyway.
And then in addition to that, even though it's not legal, I have had one case early in my career, even before I had earned my doctorate. I was working, I had a public health degree, had just gotten married, was working at a hospital in the state of Michigan, and we had moved into a neighborhood. I'd heard of a nurse that had a upstairs apartment for rent, and we rented it and moved into that neighborhood. And the week after we got there, it was about 10 o'clock in the night, we were about to go to sleep, and we saw something like a flash of light and heard something like gunshots. And we looked outside, and on the lawn, there was a cross burning.
Wow.
And whoever lit the cross had fired some gunshots to attract
the attention
of the
neighborhood
because there were black people on the street. It's an example of the fact that sometimes, and this was not some really particularly desirable neighborhood, but it's the extent to which those things still happen. Even.
And I guess it drives public funding to certain areas and starves them from blacker areas, doesn't it? Does that bleed into what you're talking about?
Historically, that has. So there's a phenomenon in the United States that we have called redlining, that banks would then redline areas where blacks lived as areas where they would not give loans or they would not give mortgages. Or if you wanted to open a store and wanted a loan to start a business, you wouldn't get because those areas were redlined. So it ensured that the lack of economic development in those areas and ensured that property values stayed low and this became a very undesirable area. So the key point is that residential segregation by race is no longer the law of the land, but for most black people are still relegated to living in areas where the majority of people are also black.
Yeah.
And because blacks are disproportionately poor, it's not only the majority of people are black, but the majority of people are poor.
Yeah.
And so you tend to have the concentration of all the social problems that go with poverty tend to be more common in those predominantly black areas.
So that's where the racial aspect comes into it, is it?
Yes.
Rather where it trumps class, I guess.
Yes, right. So, I mean, it's a combination. I think of it not as either or. It's either race or class. It's the combination of race and class together and the racism. But the point is the fact that the racial differences in economic resources is not an accident. It didn't just happen. It's not a random event. It's not an act of God. It reflects the successful implementation of social policy. Because what happens is, if you are living in a very disadvantaged area and separate schools are then created in that very disadvantaged area, in the United States, we do something very pernicious. The funding of education, elementary and high school education, is largely driven by local property taxes. So if a community does not have much economic resources, then it does not have much funds raised to fund public education. And so what you tend to have in the poorer black and other minority neighborhoods, the schools are of much poorer quality than in other areas. And so that the students are not getting the quality of preparation they need to be successful academically, and therefore they don't get the jobs they need. They don't have the social networks with linkages, informal linkages to the labor market and to opportunities for advancement. And so the residential segregation then literally determines your economic mobility and your level of economic success.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a study done by one of my colleagues at Harvard, an economist, David Cutler. And he studied with fancy econometric models I cannot even fully describe, but he isolated statistically the impact of segregation in a national study of blacks and whites in the U.S. And he estimated that if you could statistically eliminate segregation, you would completely erase black-white differences in income, in education, and in unemployment, and reduce black-white differences in single motherhood by two-thirds. Well, all of that just driven by segregation and by place.
But it's not just that, isn't it? It's even just, it's not that just that that has the impact on public health, isn't it? It's even when, I guess, African-Americans go to access their health services, there's a thing called unconscious bias as well. So there's other factors that come into play that's directly related to race.
This is a very good point. So I think there are multiple mechanisms I've written about by which racism affects health. So I was just talking about one of them.
Yeah.
Segregation.
There's a whole heap of...
Exactly. So segregation affects health because where you live determines the quality of your neighborhood environment.
Yeah.
It determines the quality of housing. It determines the quality of city services you receive. It determines your access to supermarkets and whether you have access to fresh fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
It determines the safety of your neighborhood environment, whether it's even safe to go out and walk. It determines the quality of access to parks and walking trails and safe places to be outside. It determines your access to medical care. So there are all of these. So those are mechanisms that have health and implications. The socioeconomic status differences, the differences in income and education, also have health implications. But then the larger racism in society, the fact that racism, this structure of racism, is based on an ideology of inferiority, that some groups are better than others.
And I guess it's been drummed into people for a very long time.
It's deeply, I like to say that racism is as American as apple pie. And what I mean by that, it is so deeply embedded into our culture, into our literature, into movies, into...
Every aspect of being American.
Exactly. So that I sometimes say to my students that racism for the average American is as natural as breathing.
Hmm.
You don't think to breathe. We breathe in all the time, but we don't think about it. We just live.
So it seeps into the health profession as well.
It seeps into the health profession. Our healthcare workforce are a part of the larger society. So let me give you an example of the evidence we have of racism within the healthcare domain. Back in the late 1990s, there was a physician by the name of Kevin Shulman. He went to a medical conference in the United States and got over 700 doctors to sit at a computer just for a few minutes, watch a videotape vignette of a patient where a patient described symptoms, and their doctors were asked, they were given some little prize for doing this, were asked to indicate what they would recommend as the next step given the symptoms the patient describes. The correct answer would be a cardiac catheterization. The person had described certain heart symptoms. What the physicians who took part in this study did not know is that all of the patients they saw in these videos were actors.
Hmm.
All of them had been trained to describe the symptoms with identical words. They had actually even been trained to have the same facial expressions as to describe the symptoms. They all claimed to have the same job, live in the same neighborhood. So the only thing that was different was that some were black and some were white. Some were male and some were female. And what the researchers found is that these medical doctors at this convention were much more likely to recommend cardiac catheterization, the appropriate treatment, for men over women and for whites over blacks.
Even white women over black men?
Within each race, there was a gender effect. So black men did better than black women, and white men did better than white women. I am not certain if I compared black men and white women, which group did better. I don't recall specifically.
It's an interesting
question
anyway.
It is an interesting question indeed. It was news that this study had found this, and so much so that the United States Congress voted that the Institute of Medicine, the highest medical authority in the United States, should do a study to answer the question, did what happened at a medical convention with fake patients actually occurs when blacks and other minorities go into healthcare contexts in the United States? And the issue was not, are there racial differences in access to care? There are large racial differences in access to care. But that was not the question. The question was, given access, are there racial differences in the quality and intensity of care?
Yeah, right.
I was one of 12 persons who were selected to serve on this committee, Institute of Medicine Committee. And in 2003, we released a report, about 500 pages, that's entitled The Unequal Treatment Report. And the report documented that across virtually every therapeutic intervention, from the most simple procedures to the most complex, blacks, there are more studies of blacks than any other group, but the same pattern is true for Hispanics and for American Indians, but there are more studies of blacks than any other group. Blacks and other minorities receive fewer procedures and poorer medical care than whites do.
So just you're obviously a professor at Harvard. That would still apply to you if you would still be sort of victim to that ingrained bias, I guess, by
yes,
a lot of medical
conditions. I am more likely. I think it should be clear. I want to be clear. It's what we are talking about is not the fact that every black person is discriminated against every time he or she enters a healthcare context. But on average...
But there's a possibility.
There is a possibility. And on average, a black person is much more likely. Let me give you a concrete example that would give you an illustration of the kind of evidence we did. The Institute of Medicine, by the way, a committee, doesn't do original research. What we try to do is look at what is the existing research and do we have enough to come to a conclusion one way or another given the question that we were asked. What we found was there were nearly 200 published scientific papers addressing the question, and 80% of them found that discrimination occurred that disadvantaged the minority person compared to the white person. So again, it wasn't every single study, but as scientists, we look at the weight of the scientific evidence, and nearly 200 studies and over 8 out of 10 of them are saying this is occurring. It's a phenomenon that doesn't occur every single time, but it occurs. Let me give you a concrete example. Dr. Todd was an emergency room physician at UCLA. It's a major medical center in Los Angeles. University-based medical center. So it's a place where good care, you should receive good care. And he asks a simple question. When a patient comes into the emergency department at this medical center with a long bone fracture, a broken bone in the arm or leg, does the patient's ethnicity determine whether the patient gets pain medication or not? And he looked at every patient that had been treated at that emergency department in the prior year. And he found that 56% of Hispanic patients with a broken bone in the arm or leg had not received pain medication, compared to 24% of white patients had not received. So that's a big difference. And so he's a good researcher. He said it could be something else. So he statistically took into account whether the patient spoke English or not, whether they got injured on the job or not, what time they came to the emergency department, how long they spent in the emergency department, how severe was the fracture, were they hospitalized or not, every other potential factor that could be the underlying reason. And when he statistically controlled on all of these factors, the single biggest predictor of whether a patient got pain medication was the patient was Hispanic.
Yeah, right.
Dr. Todd moved from UCLA in California to Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, repeated the same study looking at black and white patients and found the same thing. A black person with a broken bone in the arm or legs who goes to an emergency room in Atlanta is less likely to get pain medication compared to a white patient. And that's just one example. It's not about pain medication. There were more studies in the area of the treatment of heart disease than any other area. But it's found in every single area.
Now, that's overwhelming. So it's obvious that this comes into play. I guess, why hasn't America woken up to it yet?
Well, I would say, I mean, in the wake of the Institute of Medicine report, I, as well as other committee members, embarked on, got many invitations to speak at medical conferences, to talk to physicians about what the report had found, to talk to nurses about what the report had found. And I would honestly say that the average healthcare provider I spoke to would say, I would never do that.
Yeah, they don't recognize it in themselves.
Exactly, but I want to say they're part of our society, and I think they're just like other people in our society, because this is well documented in the area of medicine. It's not occurring only in the area of medicine. It's occurring in all kinds of social interactions in all areas of society. So one of the things that I do this even with my students. I tell my students I'm a prejudiced person. I'm a prejudiced person because I'm a normal human being. What research in social psychology tells us that this is not about white people. It's not about Americans. It's about how human beings process information. We process information and we simplify all of the complex cognitive information we bombarded with every day by putting things into categories.
Right.
Social categorization is a normal process.
But it's what we're taking in, I guess. That's where
it comes
in.
It's what else is in our minds already, what we have taken in from our culture.
Yeah.
And every society has in-groups and out-groups, has groups that are viewed positively and groups that are viewed negatively. And what the research finds is that when you meet someone from a group, and it's a group in which deeply embedded in your subconscious, there are negative messages you have received during your lifetime about this group, and you now meet someone and you recognize them as belonging to that group, the next two words are important. It's unconscious and it's automatic.
Right. So you can't help it.
You can't help it, and you don't even know you have done it.
Yeah.
Because you're not aware of the fact you did it. You will treat that person differently. And that is, you will discriminate against that person, but there was no intent on your part, and typically no awareness on your part that you even did it.
And that's why people get protective and they don't want to acknowledge that this is an issue.
Exactly. And so one of the things I try to do when I talk about it is to normalize it, because it actually is a fairly normal human response. That's how we function.
Yeah.
Where people differ is which society were you raised in and which are the groups that were stigmatized and that were viewed negatively. And I try to say to people, you may not have a problem based on race, based on the way you were raised and how you were socialized, and you were given counter messages that you may not, but you could have negative implicit biases about gay people. You could have negative perceptions of fat people. You could have negative perceptions of old people. You could have negative perceptions of women. So they're different social groups, or people who come from this country or this nationality or this ethnic group. So I think the first step to addressing unconscious bias, implicit bias, unconscious discrimination, not a term people use to describe it, is to realize that this could be you.
Mm.
That because you are a normal human being, you could actually be treating people differently without ever intending to do so. One of the examples I want to give is there's a very widely used test called the implicit association test. The IAT is the most widely used test to capture implicit bias. Not the only one, but the most widely used one. And it has a website. It's based Professor Banaji at Harvard.
Yeah.
Maintains that website. And
I'm positive I've done this test before.
Okay. And the developer of the test was Professor Greenwald, who works with Professor Banaji. They've written a wonderful book called Blind Spot that summarizes the research in very accessible language on it.
Yep.
But this is the point I want to make. Professor Anthony Greenwald developed the implicit association test, and he and Professor Banaji, both of them, run the website that maintain it. He developed the test. He's white. Because he was very interested in the problem and very motivated by egalitarian values. And when he took the test that he himself had developed, he discovered that he had anti-black biases.
Yeah.
And when Professor Banaji took it, she found that she too had anti-black biases. And she's from India, so she's a minority herself.
Yeah, right.
And both of them who run the test discovered that they, in fact, have anti-black biases. And I think part of the challenge that people have to be aware is that if you have implicit biases, you're not a bad person. You are just normal. You're just reflecting what you have been fed as part of growing up in American society.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's part of being in a racist society,
exactly,
isn't it? That you might not be racist, you might
yes.
be prejudiced, but in this racist society,
yes.
that ultimately results in
yeah.
racism, I guess, because it's the acts like a doctor refusing to give pain medication.
Exactly.
Exactly. Bringing it back to an Australian context, I mean, obviously, when you talk about social groups, the most demonised people here are Aboriginal people.
Absolutely.
And we just had an example up in the Northern Territory of, you know, a celebrated Aboriginal singer, particularly celebrated internationally. His pain was completely disregarded. He was basically left in the hospital to die, and a politician up there basically said it was just a publicity stunt. How do you respond to things like that? It must be, it must be obvious it's all the world around, but how do you see that when you come to Australia?
Yeah, I learned about it yesterday. I didn't know about it before. It's painful. You think when something like that happens, you would think that we had made more progress, that we weren't still back in the dark ages. At one level, at another level, it's understandable. People are very defensive. People don't want to be found guilty of being racist. Many of these people, as I said, have good intentions.
Good intentions.
Yes.
I always find that's the most destructive two words in Aboriginal affairs.
But it's. I think from their self-perception, they have good intentions. They believe in treating everyone equally. One of the take-home messages is good intentions aren't enough.
Mm.
Because there are these processes that will sabotage our very good intentions. The good intentions are not enough. And then people also get very defensive and say they want to defend themselves and want to protect. They won't like the image of being they are the hospital, the healthcare facility who treated this person badly, and so that they get defensive. I think it's really sad, and it reflects how much work we still have to do in our society. That you would think that there is such an awareness today of things like implicit bias, that there is such an awareness today of the pervasiveness and persistence of discrimination in so many domains of society that we wouldn't have to deal with it. But again, I would put it this way. There's a lot of research also indicates that we as in human beings, have very selective perceptions. that we tend to pay attention and to really accept as true things that are consistent with our worldview. And things that are not consistent, we don't see it. You see it, but we don't attend to it, and it doesn't change what we view, which is one of the reasons why it's very difficult to change stereotypes, because we selectively, anything that confirms a stereotype we have, we attend to it.
We will pick it and prioritize it.
Exactly. But when it's inconsistent, we dismiss it. We don't even attend to it, and it doesn't really fundamentally change how we think.
Now, before we actually talked about when you actually started researching race and racism and health, and I guess one of the criticisms was that, you know, it's not going to lead to any solutions. But 30 years on, do you see any solutions for this? 30 or 40 years on, however long you've been studying this, do you see any solutions?
Yeah, I would say probably 20, 25.
Not even that. But, it's very new still.
Do I see solutions? Yes. I think we are moving towards solutions. But let me emphasize, this doing work in this area was so controversial in the early days and was viewed so skeptically by scientists by some scientists in the early days, that I think the central focus of myself and other people who worked in the field was trying to document that this is real, we are measuring it, what we are finding is valid. Mm. So our focus was not on solutions, was trying to convince people that yes, there is evidence, scientifically we can conclude that racism matters for the health of disadvantaged, racially stigmatized populations. So I think that has been the focus. And it's not that everyone accepts the evidence of racism now, but I think that it's more respectable because there is a much larger body of work. The findings are more striking. I should give you an example of how striking the findings are. So the scale I developed two scales. One that captured major experiences of discrimination. Well, actually three scales. One that captured major experiences of discrimination, like have you ever been unfairly denied a promotion, unfairly not hired for a job, unfairly stopped, physically threatened or abused by the police. So it's big things that could have happened. I also developed a 9-item measure called the Everyday Discrimination Scale that says, in your day-to-day life, how often are you treated with less courtesy than others? How often treated with less respect than others? How often you receive poorer service than others at restaurants or stores? How often do people act as if they're afraid of you? And so on. So it's a lot of little indignities that you experience. Let me give you an example of some of the findings in terms of studies that have used the Everyday Discrimination Scale. It's now the most widely used measure of discrimination in studies in the world right now.
And you developed that, did you?
Yeah, I developed that. Yeah. I developed that based on reading the literature, and I give credit to Philomena Essert, is a Dutch scholar who is an immigrant from Suriname to the Netherlands, and she was studying the experience of black people in the Netherlands from Suriname, who were immigrants in Europe there. And then she also studied African-American women in California. And she, her book that she wrote was called Everyday Racism, and she was making the point that racism is not just in the big things I talked about, like not getting a promotion or not getting a job and being stopped and harassed by the police, but it's in the day-to-day little indignities that you are constantly reminded and constantly being put back. People are trying to put you back in your place that you don't quite belong. And so that was my inspiration. But to give an example of the studies now find that higher levels of everyday discrimination predicts higher levels of coronary artery calcification. That is measuring the degree of clinical buildup of heart disease in your carotid artery over 5 years. That if you have if you have reported experience of discrimination, it predicts more rapid development of measurable heart disease,
so
even after we
impact.
Statistically are taken into account other risk factors for heart disease. It predicts higher levels of high blood pressure. It predicts higher levels of inflammation by measuring in your blood the level of C-reactive protein or other markers of inflammation in the blood. And higher levels of inflammation just increases your risk for a broad range of medical conditions. It predicts among elderly people more rapid declines in cognitive function over time.
Right.
It predicts poorer sleep quality by actually measuring with actigraphy the level of sleep quality people have. In a sample of the elderly followed over time, it's literally killing people. Higher levels of everyday discrimination predicts an elevated risk of mortality. They're more likely to die in the follow-up window.
Yep.
And in a sample of black and white women, higher levels of discrimination predicts higher levels of abdominal fat or visceral fat. And abdominal fat is of two types. And they actually use imaging data to separate the abdominal fat into the very bad kind of fat, the visceral fat, which is the deep fat in between your internal organs, and the subcutaneous fat, which is the fat just under your skin. The kind of fat that really predicts risk for heart disease and diabetes and stroke is the visceral fat. Everyday discrimination was unrelated to subcutaneous fat, but predicted higher levels of visceral fat. So that's just an example of the fact that discrimination is now linked to a broad range of medical conditions. It's making people sick. It's literally killing people slowly, is the way to think of it.
Yeah.
And it is one type of stressful experiences that is having these negative effects and adversely impacting health.
You could even look at groups who have those high rates and just look at them and say, well, those are the ones who are most discriminated against. Even use those health outcomes as a measure of discrimination. Do it opposite way, I guess, using that scale.
Yes. Yes, you could. And I think the bigger point, and this has been well documented in the U.S., I don't think it's the U.S. is in any way unique. Researchers have been able to document what they are calling accelerated aging or premature aging. What I mean by that, they are able to show that blacks and other minorities are actually aging more rapidly than whites because of all of the stress we face.
So that's a lower life expectancy. That's
life expectancy, but it also means that we're getting diseases at younger ages.
Mm.
We are physiologically. Let me give you an example of one of the first studies that where the researcher coined the term weathering to describe this accelerated aging. She looked at women in the United States and women who give birth to their first baby, and looked at the age of the women. And we generally tend to think it's a good thing for women to delay childbearing from their teen years to their 20s or later, because it's good socioeconomically. You can now have your career and your education before you start raising a family. We also think it's good biologically, that your birth outcomes will be better. And what she found, that for white women and Mexican-American women, if they delay childbearing from their teens to their 20s, the infant mortality rate among the babies was lower in the 20s than it was in the teens. For black women and Puerto Rican women, those Puerto Rican women living in the United States, the opposite was true.
Yeah, right.
The lowest, the best birth outcomes were women who had babies 15 to 19. If the delay to 20
because
to 24...
Because they're getting those health outcomes as they age.
And
yeah.
Exactly. And what she's saying is that your age is not only capturing how long you have lived. If you live in a bad environment, your age is capturing how long you have been exposed to bad environmental conditions, and therefore how physiologically compromised and how weakened your body is from the wear and tear of the constant onslaught of stress, physical, chemical, in your neighborhood, in your work environment. Mm. All of the stresses, racism, financial stress, all the problems you deal with, all takes a toll and has a negative effect on health.
And we've got to leave it there, but I can see so many sort of implications with Aboriginal communities. It just is a mirror of that. So thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate your time today.
You're very welcome.
Thank